This meeting of the House Transportation Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:04 p.m. on Thursday, February 29th in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Stutes, Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Mina, Representative Nelson, Co-Chair Carrick, and myself, Co-Chair Eichheid. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Also, please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you for that. Before we begin, I would like to thank Jordan Nelson from House Records, as well as Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Our committee aides are Meredith Trainer and staffer Griffin Sakale, right at the door. Thank you for your help. Without you, this work would not be possible. On today's agenda, we will have an overview of winter maintenance and operations by the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities staff. After the DOT and PF presentation, we will consider a bill, House Bill 216, Transfer of Railroad Land to Whittier from Representative Holland, and hear invited testimony from railroad leadership and a representative from the city of Whittier. This is the first hearing of House Bill 216 in the House Transportation Committee. And I would like to say, before we get started with our first presentation, that I would like to do a hard stop with the first presentation at 2:30. Regardless of where we are, I just want to make sure House Bill 216 has adequate time. And so I'd like to invite our DOT staff to approach the dais, introduce yourselves, and begin the presentation. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee.
There we go. For the record, Andy Mills, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and I'd like to thank the committee for the request on this presentation. Just given the long list of folks that we have on the first slide, I'll let perhaps every person introduce themselves when we first kind of get to them. We're going to run through a rotation on each slide, and for all of our folks, whether in the room or on Teams, we'll try to keep each slide to about a minute to make sure we leave room for questions and get through this in the time that you're looking for. Again, thank you for this. Most people, as we've said in the past, think of DOT road maintenance in the winter as one of our primary functions. And so we understand there's a lot of passion around the subject, which we share. I might let one of my colleagues introduce this slide, and then I'll do the emergency slide after that.
For the record, Christine Langley, Data Modernization and Innovation Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So, over the last several years, we've really come to realize how important it is to not only respond to winter events and winter operations, but to get ahead of them. And so we've put in a lot of efforts, which we're excited to share with you today, to modernize our winter operations. And we know that these winter conditions affect the public, it affects the safety of all of us out there on the roadways, and we're using modern tools to move that forward and be as efficient as we can with our resources and make sure that we're getting a step ahead.
And again, for the record, Andy Mills. So, again, the assembly of all of the folks that are online, any one of those folks can be called on if there's a specific event, but slide three here is meant to illustrate that the department has an increasing role in our emergency response assistance in multiple areas across the state, multiple types of events, flooding, washouts, avalanches, landslides, storms, events that cross the border on many of these. So this slide is not meant to be read comprehensively out loud, but if, of course, there is an interest by any committee member, please let us know, and we can maybe have, again, the team assembled here that spans the entire state address any question you may have on an event.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. I did want to just introduce to the committee who's online. So we have Burrow Nicholson from the Central Region Maintenance and Operations. We have Christy Futrell from the State Equipment Fleet. And then we have, I'm going to not get his last name, Jason Sakalaskas, the engineer, I believe, for Northern Region Maintenance and Operations. So those three individuals are on the line, and Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Eichheit. So what I did want to do, Andy, or Mr. Mills, is say thank you to the DOT. We've had a number of issues in my district, Talkeetna being one of them, and Petersville being a big one. And the DOT has proven to be very willing to work with private industry and the private folks that you to help them solve a problem themselves. And I think it's refreshing. You know, a lot of times the DOT gets slammed because the latest thing, you know, what, 124 cars in the ditch between Eagle River and the Hay Flats yesterday. And, you know, you get slammed a lot, but people don't see the work that you do. I think it was a Sunday or maybe a Saturday night. I called you guys. You had the team activated. And so I really appreciate the work you do in the emergency response realm especially. And it's refreshing, actually.
Andy Mills, for the record, thank you. Indeed, my commissioner says DOT is uniquely positioned to assist with emergency response simply because we have contractor contracts open and contractor relationships. So a huge shout out to AGC and many of our contracting community who are either mobilized in communities and ready to respond or are very quick to assist because we already have those established relationships and contracts. And so it does place us in a unique position to be able to respond quickly when there's an emergency across the state.
Christine Langley, for the record. So as I mentioned before, advancing a proactive approach to winter maintenance is really where we've been working over the last couple years. We've been acquiring more tools that allow us to do predictive condition analysis, whether this is partnering with the Weather Service, ingesting real-time traffic data, looking at the live backups when they happen to occur at our signals around the state, and putting all of those pieces together in order to get a step ahead. One area that we have really been able to make advances in over the last year is communication. And so for some of the first time, we've been able to actually put Starlink onto vehicles. We can watch those vehicles travel all the way up the Dalton, all the way back down. And it allows us to get a sense of the real-time conditions that are going on out there. So we know that increased data is what allows us to create the situation where people can make safe decisions for themselves. And so over the last year, during 2025, we saw 1.2 million individuals come to us and come to 511 to look for information, whether that was traffic speeds, bridge heights, plow status, road conditions, you know, road closures and updates during events. We've been expanding our road weather information system, and we've been using a lot of this data integrated together to create the items that you see there on the screen. 511 shows the status of where plows are active in the last 2 hours, and on the right, you can see our winter operations dashboard. And it's small print, but if you zoom into the area you're interested in on the winter operations dashboard, it immediately ingests the RWIS cameras that are in that surrounding area. It allows you to toggle through over time to see where plows may have been. And this will, and it includes the road priorities. So this lets you know if maybe while you're in here today, a plow happened to go through while you were busy, but the road is cleared on your way home.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Co-Chair Eichheit. So how long has 511 been operational?
Through the Co-Chair, Representative Stutes, I'm not entirely sure. I can get back to you on that.
Follow up. I just want to mention that when coming to Juneau this year, we drove down. We caught the ferry out of Kodiak and then caught a ferry again. That is an incredible asset. I was just overwhelmed and amazed at how efficient and effective 511 was. We ran into other people that were driving down too, and it was just the common thread amongst us all. And it was, like you were saying with the Starlink, it's so immediate. It's really incredible. I commend you. That's a real resource and a real advantage to Alaskans. Thank you.
For the record, Christine Langley, through the chair, Rep. Stutes, thank you very much, first off. We've definitely worked hard. It takes a very large team behind us who, you know, aren't here today but are all putting data into that system. Over the next year, we're actively working, and we hope to put into place where the ferries are traveling. And so we're hoping will help people understand real-time, you know, departure times, docking times, and travel.
Representative St. Clair.
Thank you. Through the chair, I want to echo the kudos from Representative Stutes. I've driven the Alcan from Wasilla to Haines Junction to Haines over the past, I'd say, 10 years, 8 times. And it's all been in the wintertime. Or even when I do it in the summertime, you know, it's a great asset. We missed a couple of avalanche closures on the Haines Highway and the Klondike Highway because 511 was there. The only, and of course, got to come with a ding, your cameras. Some of your cameras have been down quite a while. Not necessarily on, you know, going through Haines, etc., but some of the ones on the Seward Highway, etc., because we do check those. When we're getting ready to go dip netting or something else, we check the cameras to see what's going on. Is there a plan to upgrade the phones or the cameras or to facilitate getting them back online? Thank you.
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, Representative St. Clair, we'll take both the kudos and the ding. That's fair. We have been working on upgrading the camera systems that we have. Many of them are aging out. We're working hard to shift some of our funding sources, so we've been using what are our research funds. They used to often be used for long-term, multi-year research, and we're trying to switch them to real-time or near-time results for the individuals out on the roadway. We have put in the first fully solar RWIS system in Turnagain Pass using those funds. We are working one on the north side of Attigan Pass as well, both areas that we have really struggled to keep cameras up, and we're going to keep working towards that for sure.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I had about the mobile reporting apps is we've been encouraging, you know, through the Sutton Community Council for people to use these apps for all kinds of stuff, whether it's loose animals to these types of things like reporting road conditions, one of those being Moose Creek, which maybe we can talk about later. But the question that I had was when those reports come through, how are they prioritized?
Christine Langley, for the record, through the co-chair, Representative Nelson. So there's very little that we put into these slide decks, so I'm going to take your comment and expand a little bit. So we both are using mobile reporting for our staff so that they're able to update these conditions in virtually real time. We also are about to release a Report a Concern app to the public, and it's going to cover as many things as we could come up with, whether that's a safety concern, a visibility concern, potholes, guardrail, you know, which way do I turn at the next stop? I don't know. One of the things that we are working through now is really how to prioritize those and how to make sure that the things that are urgent get addressed right away. And so currently they're going to all go to our Ask DOT email group, which is handled by our comms account. And then from there, they're going to also go to, you know, M&O if they're an M&O related concern, our highway safety office if they're a safety concern, and make sure that we get those out there. Like all things that we attempt to innovate, we might not achieve perfect on day one, but we're always here to learn from that.
Cool. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So two things. You know, of course, that probably half the bush pilots in Alaska use your cameras for weather reporting. You know, I mean, I use it all the time. So, but I wonder if there's integration into Waze or Google Maps being considered or even in there right now so that you know, sometimes you get a Waze notification that says, you know, accident ahead or something like that. And it'd be really great, once again, to be able to sit in the coffee shop and have Waze tell me that the sanding truck just went by and I could follow him to Anchorage.
Through the chair, Christine Langley, for the record, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. You can see the plow truck on 511 while you're in the coffee shop. I'm happy to show you more about that, but that's what you're seeing there on the left. We do have We put in some airport things today. We intend to expand that system over time, and that includes NOTAMs, because we are aware that, you know, not only pilots are using those cameras, but folks that are doing off-road travel between, you know, points are doing using those cameras. So we're certainly open to hearing more ideas. We're always working on a balancing act of not overwhelming people.
Follow up. Thanks. So, yeah, that sort of triggered another question. Is Mr. Mills and I had a conversation a couple years ago, I think, about a state airport dashboard, and maybe you're going to get to that, or maybe I would be interested in hearing how far along that is, so pilots could tell if the we've had a couple accidents at the Big Lake Airport where the person landed, didn't know it wasn't plowed, sunk into deep snow, and went over on their back, and it would have been helpful to know that the plowing was done at that airport. Before he or she ever took off from Merrill or wherever they left from. So,
for the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, I will look into that and get back to you and back to the committee. Definitely, these are the kinds of efforts that we're working on. So we're working hard to take all these aggregate or pieces of data we have and aggregate them into information products for the public. So we'll work.
Thanks.
And for the record, Andy Mills, through the chair, Representative McCabe. One of the things that Christine was just talking about is the integration of NOTAMs. One of the sensitivities I know we have, and then we'll move on if the committee would like, is not having too many different dashboards or sources you need to go to. So 511 is a great example where every single year we've added a feature or we're working on something, additional integration, and that's a natural place to put information that would work, and it's just another layer to put in there so that you're giving a sort of clearinghouse of best and relevant information. So that was envisioned rather than a separate dashboard, although additional features like the winter operations dashboard may call for a separate dashboard.
Thanks.
And I'll just get in the queue with a question about you had here, AI-supported surface analysis. And as I look at this slide, you know, there's a lot of incredible technologies that have really changed the face of transportation. So just briefly, it might be a whole nother hearing topic, but is the department using more AI, or is it using AI in different ways? Because it's kind of like the topic of the day for many folks, AI and how it's used.
For the record, Christine Langley, co-chair, Eichheid. I think the simple answer is yes, we are using more. It doesn't mean that we immediately assume that that data is valid. So, for example, with our road weather information system, we are testing several cameras around the state through our rapid research program, in which you tell the camera what type of surface you're looking at. Am I looking at asphalt, a bridge, gravel? And from that, it fine-tunes the algorithm to be able to help us determine and provide us information and alerts that there could be icing soon. We have systems like Pike Alert that take in the weather conditions and start to use those algorithms and some of that newer AI technology to help us make predictions. But at the end of the day, it's our people still.
And Andy Mills, for the record, also, Mr. Co-Chair, there's a real tension when you go to at the AASHTO, the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, which is all the DOTs. They hold conferences throughout the year, and AI is one of the top topics. But you find a lot of consternation in how state executives treat that subject. Some have basically outright banned it. Others are embracing it. And I think there's a healthy mix because you don't want confidently wrong information. And we did try a STIP chatbot, which we gave, I believe, to a previous presentation. It was not as reliable as we would have hoped for, and therefore it wasn't sort of a premiere that we pushed forward. Probably the technology not quite there yet, and we don't want to give inaccurate information or information that's lacking context that is important. So, again, an area to not ignore, but also to be sure we're rolling out appropriately.
Thank you.
For the record, Christine Langley. So all of these digital tools take training, and training for our staff, training for the public. As I think you heard in a previous presentation, we're about to roll out a automated, also using an AI algorithm, pedestrian light in Kodiak that detects a pedestrian as they cross the crosswalk. These take education for the public and for our own staff. And so we're working hard to be able to do that. We're releasing tools like Samsara, which are cameras located on our equipment that allow us to visually see what the operator might see, that lets us help them as they're proceeding through their job. It allows us to assist in how we're rating the roads because we can work together. these technologies allow us to bring technical experts in who might not be on site, and that's been very helpful for us. So as we work on building the safety into our winter operations, we're bringing out a couple new tools in the next couple months. So one of them is called DriveWise. DriveWise is a tool that is mainly useful for the commercial industry. Various fleet vehicles often receive these alerts. They include things like bridge ahead, rapid slowdown in traffic, things that they may need to know, steep descent ahead, and help them make, you know, safe day-to-day operations. In addition to that, we're bringing out we're putting these pieces together. And so actually, as was mentioned by Representative McCabe, there was many vehicles in the ditch the other day. We were able to see that traffic change, that traffic speed ahead. We knew those weather conditions were coming, and that allowed us to immediately and remotely get into the digital message board that's on that road and alert people to the crash that had occurred ahead of them. We don't always get to see how often that changes, but in this case, we were able to see some of that slowdown in traffic. We did this a couple months ago as well, also on the Glen Highway, when we realized that people were exiting due to a snow condition rapidly towards the valley, and we could watch those changes in real time and be able to proactively warn people.
Co-Chair Carey?
Thank you, through the co-chair. I thank you all for being here today. The safety initiatives to support vulnerable road users, you had mentioned the Kodiak crosswalk, and we heard about that before. What are maybe some other examples of technology supporting vulnerable road users or integration? I'm just curious.
Through the co-chair, Representative Carrick. I'm just going to say sorry right now.
Through the co-chair to the co-chair.
There we go. Okay. For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair to the co-chair, Carrick. Did I mention not perfect on our first attempt here? We are looking at many different ways of utilizing that. Some of that is increasing the audible systems that we have in place. Some of that, you know, all of these technologies that we're talking about today, even 511, you don't have to be in a vehicle to use those. And so those are available to vulnerable road users to use as well. We have investigated some software applications that pedestrians and cyclists can utilize, you know, can carry on their body, whether that is a phone app or some other way that they're doing it, and it alerts them to rapid changes in the traffic patterns approaching them or vehicles that are in the turn lane next to them. One of the things that we're facing in Alaska is that crowdsourcing without a crowd is difficult, and a lot of these tools depend on that. And so that's one where we're just continually working on looking at what's out there, seeing how we can utilize it. As Mr. Mills pointed out, we certainly don't want to be providing inaccurate information or information without context, and so we're continually looking for new ways that we can do that.
And for the record, Andy Mills, I think you heard it in the HSIP safety presentation, but again, we have a fairly strong campaign. I'm holding my book because legends deserve to be seen, reflective gear, and we are trying to get hats and other reflective gear out to folks that are typically your pedestrians or transit users, but folks who would be in the dark in the winter, and we want to be sure that they're seen, because being seen is half the battle when it comes to safety. And of course, illumination is the other half, right? So we're tackling this from multiple, but that, for as far as safety initiatives, that's another good example of trying to change the scenario without changing the geometry of the area.
I have a quick follow-up. Thank you, through the co-chair. I love my own armband that I have about Legends Deserve to Be Seen. That campaign is really great. How is DOT helping get some of that swag material, I guess you could say, out in the community? Is DOT themselves, or do you have safety partners that are doing tabling, or, you know, how are we getting some of those things out?
To expedite this, Andy Mills, for the record. So there's numerous things, and I'm happy to make a note and get you sort of a more comprehensive list. But I know I've brought several boxes when I've been traveling down and giving them to folks out at our 7 mile location. I know that they're going to various events. We've also asked transit operators if there's an opportunity for us to meet where the buses are, the central locations, and make sure we're able to hand that out. I heard a story about a representative the other day that saw someone that she nearly hit and stopped her car and threw one of our hats, I believe, at them. And the reaction of the individual was to be scared, not thank you for the reflective gear. So there's a lot of different ways this is getting out there.
I'd be scared if you threw.
So,
but I wasn't that person, by the way.
Not in this room, but it was appreciated that message is being carried forward, that stuff is going out. Let me get a comprehensive list back to you, though, and the ways we're getting it out.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so a couple things. Community councils are a really good way. We've handed out like the Narcan things at community councils before. If you had somebody that wanted to come up to like Big Lake or Wasilla Area Chamber or Community Organization or Talkeetna and just give a little brief and hand those out, especially in the Big Lake area where sometimes the snow plowing doesn't happen because we're a class 25 road or whatever it is. and people have to walk on the road in the wintertime, so it would be great to have that that thing. I want to shift gears a little bit, though. A number of years ago, one of my team went to a meeting with the Wasilla mayor, and it was a sort of a transportation. I think the troopers were there and others. And one of the things that they highlighted was the wreckers and the tow trucks on the Glen in the parks especially are struggling. In fact, a lot of them won't even go out there during the high traffic times to pull a wreck off the road because people don't slow down for flashing yellow lights, because virtually every single plow truck in the state has a flashing yellow light, and they all think it's important to have that on when they're on the Glen, and people can't see the tow truck driver. So I wonder if the DOT, maybe one of your AASHTO things, could explore finding a better light system, and we'd have to put it in statute because I think the flashing lights for the highways are in statute, but we'd have to put it in statute. But if you could even just point me in some direction where I could find out a better way for the tow trucks to light their trucks so they could actually go out during rush hour and pull somebody out of the ditch without fearing for their lives, because Alaskans are not slowing down for flashing yellow lights. Anyways.
Again, for the record, through the chair, Representative McCabe, there are the Pie Lights Initiative, which we've talked to this, the detachable magnetic lights that you put out, and they sequence, so it's like directing, not just a flare, and they last longer, and they're rechargeable. There's initiatives we have on that front. And then I know I'm channeling Pam Golden, who was here before. Cosbacuity is the word of the day. Did you hear that one before, Cosbacuity?
Cosbacuity.
That means for something to be conspicuous. So we don't implement something everywhere, otherwise it is not distinguishable and alerting. It becomes normal. So and I think you're describing a phenomenon that if something happens too often, people sort of autopilot it out. And so perhaps there's something to explore if you're looking for a particular situation that may be more difficult to be more apparent, that it needs to be, people need to be on alert. So.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. I'm going to request for a minute and just ask a question. You're talking about this reflective gear. I haven't seen it. I'm not familiar with it. So if I have a town hall, where would I get some, and where would the people, my constituents or anyone's constituents, go to get some of it?
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, we have partners in safety, and if we can pull up the email and we'll make sure that you have it. It is on our website if you look up partners in safety. Anyone who writes to that address, I probably shouldn't say anyone. If you write to that address, we will do our best to get there. We are working hard. I've heard many good suggestions on how we find individuals and opportunities to pass that out today. We have used many of those, but we have not covered the state. So this is a new initiative for us in the last year. And I'm happy to know that Co-Chair Carrick has an armband, so that's great. And we'll make sure that we make an effort to find out what locations in your area would be good to partner with.
Thank you.
Andy Mills, for the record, through the chair, Representative Stutes, more than that, I will bring you everyone in the committee. I'm the everyone gets a car thing. I will bring you reflective gear, all of the members of this committee, and make sure that you have some to take to your district or have in your office.
Perfect. That's cool.
Thank you. And I had a couple questions, but I'm going to just, I think, wait. It has to do with vulnerable users and plowing snow sidewalks so people can get, you know, to their spots when they can. So, but I'll hold that for now.
For the record, Christine Langley. So, you know, every day when we are proactively handling these winter events, the truth is we're practicing for the days that aren't as good in our emergencies. And this ability to aggregate data and turn it into information in a hurry, the ability to pull it in from remote locations that we might not have been able to connect with before, the benefits of that really came to light during the West Coast storm, where we could have small teams deployed into rural areas. We could bring that data back and be that focal point to share that information with other state agencies, FEMA, and emergencies providers. One of the things that we are also rolling out in the next month is going to be called Alaska Alerts. And that what this does is it initiates two-way communication with individuals in an area during an emergency or emergent event. And so, for example, if we have, you know, a few years ago, we had a portion of the Seward Highway that was shut down for several hours. This would allow us to create a geofence in that area, reach out to the individuals who are there, and start a conversation with them to give them more information and to help them let us know if there are things that they need, if they're running out of fuel, if they have young children that are getting cold, whatever the situation may be.
Please proceed.
For the record, Andy Mills. So we had transitioned from sort of some of these innovations and areas that we're working on to a Brian conversation. So there's about five slides here, which I will step through and of course, take any questions. This is a very high level on Brian. So Brian is a term not just for smoking salmon or making dill pickles. In this case, we are rendering sea salt, effectively is what this is, sodium chloride, and it is an anti-icing, de-icing agent. So most people are aware, of course, if a plow truck is going through and they're dropping sand behind them, that sand normally has a little bit of salt in it to keep the pile from freezing up. So there's usually some mixture of salt in the sand because we have large sand piles. That same salt can be rendered into a liquid form with a fairly sophisticated machine that has a spectrometer and everything else to get a 23.3% mixture, which is the sweet spot. And also we add corrosion inhibitor agents to bring the corrosive nature of that chemical down for application on roadways. And you can do two things. You can anti-ice, which is to treat before an event. That keeps the snow that's compacted from forming ice and sticking. Easier for a blade to come and pick it right up. Or you can de-ice, which, of course, is after that bonding has occurred, and try to knock that down to the extent that you can. There are areas in Fairbanks where it's a whole new layer of ice, and that's our new baseline, and we work from there. But it is temperature-specific as to when you can use it. And the flow chart on the right is to just show it's not simply operator discretion. There's a decision tree that's made based on forecast, conditions, and everything else as to when is the appropriate time to utilize brine. But also wanted to put on here that brine can take different forms. We're using basically a rendered sea salt into liquid form, but there are alternatives. Beet juice is one of the interesting ones. Yes, you can render beets from a farm into a de-icing agent. However, it's reportedly a bit sticky, dark in color, so the public gets concerned when they see sort of darkened slush. And it is more expensive, which in this case is one of the important factors because in our budgetary times that we're in, we're looking for cost efficiency and how we're keeping our roads safe. Urea is one of the other alternatives that I've highlighted here. Urea is a byproduct from an animal, which I won't put on the record, but you can look it up. It does have an odor to it, which is not that attractive. And it is an agent that when you put it down is very effective. However, it causes the vegetation when it sort of washes off to the side of the roads. The vegetation grows quite well, which, of course, results in another maintenance effort on our operator's part and goes through more blades trying to mow and keep that down. So there are alternatives. However, sodium chloride and products like it, when rendered into a brine and applied, is cost-effective in multiple ways. And I have another slide to go through as to sort of a comparison as to why.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So let's, for for folks that are very concerned about brine, let's flesh out the anti-corrosive stuff. So growing up in Minnesota, they put salt directly on the roads. It was horrible. Cars rusted out in a couple of years, the rocker panels, the fender wells. You don't see that so much anymore, and I suspect it's because you're using corrosion inhibitors in that brine. So maybe you could just touch on that either here or somewhere down the line about how effective it actually is to preventing rust. And I think there's a cost-benefit analysis to be done on, you know, it's great if your car doesn't rust out, but if there's not enough salt on the road to keep you out of the ditch, you're going to have different problems. So,
yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe, correct. And when we get to some of the slides and areas, you can ask Mr. Sakalaskas from Fairbanks. We rarely use brine because the conditions there are not conducive to utilizing it. There are other areas in the Matsu Valley where when, I believe it was like to 2014 time frame, brine was evaluated and determined not to be a good match for the valley. But folks need to, because of microclimate differences, folks need to remember that brine is the same compound or salt that is being put down in a solid form. People are making a distinction that brine is somehow very different. And want to reinforce to folks, it is the exact same, but rendered in a different form. So I'll leave it there for now. And I'll get to the corrosion inhibitors here in one more slide.
Thanks.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick on the matrix. I like this. Are we talking about 15 degrees Fahrenheit? Just checking, because like both of them made sense. So it's 15 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, thank you.
And through the chair, Representative Nelson, there actually is sodium chloride, calcium chloride, magnesium chloride. So I use sodium because it's the most common. When we do use other substances, you can get to different ranges that get you further down. But of course, it tends to be more corrosive the more aggressive agent you use.
And Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Through the Co-Chair, just on the brine, has DOT or Environmental Conservation looked at any of the environmental impacts related to either the sand, salt, brine, or even the other alternatives?
Through the Chair, Representative Mina, good question. I'm going to let some of my contemporaries talk to you about Clear Roads, which is a national agency that provides standards and what we do there. And also in this, we talk a bit about a lit review, what it was and what it was not. And I'll address a bit that question at that time as well. But in the Anchorage area in particular, again, Mr. Nickerson, who is on, can give you a little bit more about that. Again, a bit different. My understanding is they have spent the capital to build basically a large area. They put the sand in and spray it with a brine mixture that puts the brine onto the sand, and then that lets it burn in on when it's put down. I like to call it hot sand because that sounds kind of cool, but it's basically a brined sand, and I'll let them get into more detail on that. But you can see different application methods depending on what infrastructure you've invested in to create the product you use. And so you can see more in more rural jurisdictions, we're not using brine because we haven't established the infrastructure there. So this was just a quick slide. I typically try not to use anything that has a company name on it, but in this case, it was a very it made sense to show this because it gives you the comparison in a way that our own information would be more difficult to describe. So very straightforward here. You can see on the left-hand side what brine equates to as opposed to a comparison of equivalent solid rock salt, road salt. And you can see from a de-icing standpoint, you use far less product. So, Representative Mina, your question about the environmental impact of some of the products going down, brine is less going into the environment because it basically application-wise is putting less product down overall. And that can be from the application and also the bounce and scatter. When you put something solid, it can bounce off. It can blow off by sand by wind. So there's a lot of reasons why brine direct application stays in place and is active there. And then you can see per mile you're using less. You can also, I believe, apply it at a faster speed, which of course equates to time for our operators. And then I did like on here the important part about anti-icing, treating beforehand, the amount of times that our operators have to go to the same location and try to knock the snow down, it does take fewer operators and less equipment going out to that same location as frequently. So from a strictly cost or budgeting standpoint, the advantages are fairly clear. From the environmental standpoint, one could certainly argue that Brian is more environmentally friendly because of the application amount. And then from, again, our operator efficiency standpoint, they're not out there as often, which can translate to a numerous benefits. But I realize everything is a trade-off. And as you perhaps use less product, you may need to use more sand. Sand can clog storm drains. It can chip cars and paint and everything. So there's always a trade-off in any approach you take.
Co-Chair Carrick?
Thank you, through the co-chair. If we were to, and I'm not necessarily advocating for this, but if we were to just set aside the cost differential and the amount needed differential, you have this paragraph here that says, without brine, the cost of additional salt, sand, increased equipment, all of the above. I'm just curious, though, on the effectiveness, like if you are using all of those things to sort of achieve essentially the same effect, which one is more effective? Or is there a best practice there? Again, I'm not necessarily advocating that we just get rid of the brine. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. Representative Carrick, because it's so location specific, what I might do is, if it's okay, is when we go through some of the locations, have each of the chiefs who, the M&O chiefs who know jurisdictionally and can give you a sense of that. What this is meant to say is we try to keep the roads to a certain standard, and there is a trade-off. If you eliminate brine, you do need to add additional resourcing, and the right-hand side graph is meant to illustrate the why. So. This is a Kenai Peninsula spotlight, not just because we presented this in Senate Transportation, where the chair is from the Kenai. It is actually an area we've had the most conversations about brine, so it felt right to leave this in and show folks this as a spotlight. We heard through a resolution from the community council, the assembly there, that they did not want brine on the Kenai Peninsula. The compromise from the department was to do a significant reduction in brine application, and we kept it only to the highest speed roads. And so that was our ability to reduce it without additional resourcing. And so we shifted our practices on the Kenai. The M&O station there has done a very laudable job at trying to balance the maintenance of all the roads there with minimizing the use of brine. This slide is to illustrate. We reduced it from all roads except these, and it was the department's attempt to be responsive to local concerns. And certainly one could say, if we're overusing a strategy that the area does not like, then we want to be responsive and try and balance those interests. I would say that there are a lot of shopping malls and stores and everyone else that put a much more aggressive product in their parking lots and sidewalks. That is on cars and on tires and runoff. And so it's not all just the department as a means of explaining. There's a lot more out there. So,
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Through the co-chair, Mr. Mills, I'm wondering about when we did this. Of course, it's only been 2 years, but are we tracking the number of accidents that we may have caused by under-brining, if you will, the roads on the Kenai? In other words, has there been a spike in or jump in traffic accidents or vehicles in distress or in the ditch?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, no, but only because our operators are attempting to keep the same standard, relatively speaking, that they were doing before. So we shifted resourcing to minimize, but without attempting to compromise the safety of the roads. There's a slide that comes up next to sort of explain the dynamic that's being created by not using brine on certain roads.
Okay, I can wait for that slide for the next one.
So this next is to that very slide. Again, credit to one of the other transportation chair's constituents for providing this in a text from that legislator to me asking what's going on this road. And my reply, I didn't have to get a hold of the M&O station because I know what's happening with Mackey Lake Road here. Why is there washboarding because Mackey Lake Road is one of the roads. I mean, it's one reason why it's in this condition. We are not using brine on it anymore. And therefore, any cars that get on this road and compact that snow down will create ice that binds. And ice that binds is difficult to get up with a blade. And so you will see this where there has been compacting before we can clear. And because this is a priority 3 road and not a priority 1 road, it will have a higher tendency to get into this condition without pre-treatment or anti-icing treatment.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, that kind of brings up my second question from the last slide is how much more is it costing us, the state, the DOT, to maintain the roads to the same level of safety with less brine? Is there an estimate on that? In other words, you said on the last slide that it's maybe probably not as many accidents as we might think, but it's only because your guys are working harder, or have we started figuring out a way to work smarter, or how's that work? Or maybe it's just that we're not spending the time on these roads and we have more time to spend on those roads.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't have the safety information yet. Again, only 2 years, but it's a good thing for us to go back and look at. But I can say our operators live in these areas. Their families live in these areas. They do not want to compromise the safety of the roads. And so if they felt that this was compromising safety, I believe that they would be more vocal in saying we have to return to brine, at least on these roads. Again, we're brining the higher speed roads, and speed equals a higher risk factor for pedestrians and others on those roads. So on the slower speed limit roads, I think from a safety standpoint, a condition that reflects we live in Alaska is something that more folks are probably going to work through if it's a brine reduction that they've asked for.
Thanks.
And I just want to recognize that Representative Kai Holland has joined us in the gallery. Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, just to follow up to that very last point, was Mackey Lake Road one of these roads where the community had asked for a discontinuation of brine use?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Carrick. So they asked for no brine on the peninsula, period. And our response to that was to reduce it well over 50% and keep it only on the high-speed roads. So Mackey Lake, as a slower speed road and a priority 3 road, met the criteria for reduction.
Quick follow-up.
And through the co-chair, what's kind of the response post discontinuation on some of these roads? I'm just curious, because a lot of times constituents complain about brine. I think any of us that have, I certainly get it occasionally, but having toured the department facilities in Northern Region and knowing how infrequently brine is used, it strikes me as not quite the source of the problem that people think they're solving sometimes. But what has been the feedback now that this is the current condition of Mackey Lake Road, for example, or other areas in the Kenai Peninsula?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Carrick, the response has largely been much more quiet. Folks not as vocal about the concern, because I think for some residents, this balanced out their concern. I know I'm in direct contact with some of the folks who circulated the petition that received around 6,000 signatures, other folks on the peninsula to continue to find ways to do what we can. This last summer was, can we cover piles with a tarp and put a heater underneath it so that we don't have to put salt, so that's less salt out there. There's a number of conversations that I continue, because we're always trying to do what we can to meet the concerns that we hear. But largely speaking, the reduction, I think, met a lot of people's goals of seeing less brine use on the peninsula. And so that's where we're at the moment.
Just one more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you so much for the indulgence, Co-Chair Eichheit. So I guess the other question here is, are we spending proportionally more now? Because you had mentioned earlier trying to maintain to the same level with or without brine usage, because we want to do that as DOT. So do we spend proportionally more on some of these roads than, say, like roads in other regions where we are still using brine? And can you talk about that fiscal difference for that region?
through the co-chair, co-chair Carrick. So I'm aware of no funding that was diverted to assist with this reduction. I do know some equipment that was sent that direction to assist with making sure operators had alternatives to brine trucks to assist tow plows. And so from a resourcing standpoint, certainly we resourced some of this request, but not a divergence of funding. And the M&O folks will tell you, because I've heard it lots, that you cannot compare one lane mile of road in one part of the state to another and have it be an entire apples to apples. There's a lot of factors that go in to this, the conversation of comparison. And one of my last slides here is we did conduct, as part of our commitment to the Kenai Peninsula, a brine literature review, or lit review. And that was an effort from the research folks to just look at what literature was out there about corrosion, brine use, and in this case, what we could do for mitigation measures. And this was Laura Fay from Montana State University, a well-respected individual in maintenance, winter maintenance. She assisted us with this project, and it was in collaboration with the maintenance and operations folks. And it did have materials for our department use and for the public, fact sheets and whatnot, to make sure folks were very clear about what we could do to mitigate corrosion from brine use, chemical use, because it's a core to clearing some of our roadways as efficiently as possible. And also, there are some folks who live in the state who do have some expectation that you can see some of the pavement in the wintertime, at least some of the time. Juneau, I know what that's like because we get a lot of rain, but in other parts of the state, if we used different strategies, you would probably not see the pavement very often. So the mitigation strategies are often undercoatings on vehicles, washing the vehicles. There's a number of different things, but that literature review is available for folks who would like to find it.
And I'll ask a question because I think this is your last brine slide. So a comment and then a question. You know, I think this is a topic of great interest to Alaskans. Like Representative McCabe, I come from the Midwest, and brine and salt use is a science there, and they really lay it down, and cars consequently rust. One of the things a lot of my constituents say is Alaska is an expensive place to live. And one way you mitigate that is you buy an old car, and in my case, a Toyota or Suzuki. And they will last a long time. The engine will. But, you know, rust is a great equalizer. So before I get to my question, I think it'd be a worthy topic for another hearing, you know, especially to see, is DOT moving towards this? Is there a policy? What's the guidance on it? But I know, as a data-driven person, it'd be really interesting to look at some of the things Representative McCabe brought up. You know, what is the impact of brining roads and, you know, the cost benefits to just help educate people? But the question I had, Is brining a adaptation that DOT might use to deal with staff vacancies? You know, as you have, if you have a vacancy rate, if you don't have operators to either deliver, you know, plow the roads and or fix the equipment as it breaks down, is brining a efficiency response? And that's not I'm not trying to do a hidden gotcha thing there. I'm just kind of wondering, because people want the roads plowed or treat it, whatever. So that's my question.
Co-Chair Carrick, or Co-Chair Eichheit, thank you. So I'll probably let, again, the M&O chiefs who are on and with me maybe address the vacancy piece when they get to it. But I would say brine is not being adopted to manage vacancies. It's to manage budgetary constraints, largely. And it's also an efficiency factor. I mean, it's, even if we were not in a budgetary constrained environment, it is an efficiency factor by itself. It's worth pointing out that in the Department of Transportation, that the maintenance and operations, which is under the highways and aviation component, is one of the few areas of pure state UGF, and so therefore the last 10 plus years of budget constraints and reductions have certainly required that we tighten our belt and find efficiencies there. And that has necessitated embracing innovation and technology like brining. And so I think that's what I'll leave it at and let the M&O folks answer as they go through some slides if we get to those.
Yeah, thank you. That was a very useful answer, so very helpful.
And so we're at a slide 14 where Mr. Nickerson, who is on Teams, can jump in.
Thank you, Andy. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, Mr. Nickerson. Please put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Burrell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations, and I'm calling out of Anchorage, Alaska. I'm going to address three questions that I think have been brought up. I'm going to try and get through those quickly, and then in an effort to get through my slides really fast, I want you all to see the rest of my co-staff. So do we use inhibitor? Yes. We currently utilize brine techniques in Anchorage as well as the Peninsula District. So that is something we do, and yes, we do use an inhibitor. There was a question asked about what is most effective. And really, this is a complicated question, and I think Andy pointing out the literature review, I believe, possibly speaks to this. Again, that's a very difficult question to answer yes, no. I would say that that's very much weather dependent, but what I will say is M&O strives for bare pavement. So we would love to have bare pavement, no slippery surfaces, and that's what we strive for. Third question. Does brine, can we use it to supplement for staff vacancies? I'm going to go ahead and just sit on the coattails of what Andy said, and that isn't what we use it for. It's another tool in the toolbox of meeting the expectations of the public and meeting the need for safer roads. And unless there's any additional questions I didn't answer, I will try and blow through my slides here really quickly.
Yes. Just let me just do a time check, sir, just for the committee's awareness. It's 2:01, so I do intend to move on to the next topic on the agenda at 2:30. So just for your pacing awareness. Go ahead, Mr. Nickerson.
Thank you. So real quick, Central Region, as of 3 years ago, we started initiating snow and ice removal contracts. We started in Anchorage 3 years ago, and we have since branched out to Matsu District as well as Peninsula District. We have all locations except for one, the Soldotna area, which we got no bidders for. This kind of walks you through our contracted cost for those for FY25 and what we currently have for FY26. These numbers were put together for call-outs last week, so you all have been aware of what happened in Anchorage, so you can, so I can tell you that we utilized a contractor, just the other contractor, three different contracts, three times, I believe, so there's an addition to that. So these contracts are for priority 3 and 4 roads, and what this allows our M&O forces to do is stick to the priority 1s and 2s. And so it really makes us efficient, lets us get through our work really fast, especially for long events when we have to go, when we have to repeatedly go back to like priority ones because the snow just keeps on coming and coming and coming. Next slide.
Mr. Nickerson, co-chair Aishad here, just with a question. So on the priority one roads, I think, if my recollection is correct, that the goal is to clear those within 12 hours. So, and especially those are the most important roads for many folks. What's your success rate on meeting that goal, that standard, would you say? And I know it might be a winter specific, but and every winter is different, but if you can give us a sense of your achievement of that goal. And since your central region, Anchorage is my interest, but you know, we have folks here from all over the state.
Again, for the record, Burrell Nickerson, through the co-chair, we are for the most part quite successful at getting through our priority one roads. I don't actually have that number offhand. That is something though that we can get back to you If it's for priority ones throughout Central Region, we're happy to provide that information. But I don't have that right now.
Yes. We'll get back to you. Yes, sir. Please provide that, including Northern Region, too, where my co-chair is from. So please proceed.
Next question, or next slide. Thank you, Andy. Central Region sidewalk equipment. Sidewalks have become a big deal, especially within the last few years. And after those two large snow years we had in Anchorage, this just kind of gives you an idea of the equipment that Central Region has for clearing sidewalks. We're really trying to utilize this equipment as best we can, and we're trying to meet the public's expectations as fast as we can. I want to take this moment and say that we also have created a new priority system for our sidewalks. Christine, who is sitting in front of you, might be able to speak to that later on, but that has been an effort that her section, as well as maintenance and operations, has been spearheading so that we can get that information out to the public. And it does have different response times than the adjacent roads.
Thank you. Representative Mina had a question, sir. It might be the previous slide. I'm not sure, but Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Through the Co-Chair, just related to the priority levels for both sidewalks and for those roads, how are those priority levels decided by the department?
They, through the co-chair, again, for the record, Burrell Nickerson, we have another expert who was instrumental in putting that together, and that is Jason Sakalakis in Northern Region. So if you'd like the details, I don't want to throw you under the bus, Jason, but I think you had a large part to do with that. But I will say that there's a lot of variables that go into that, ADT, the speed of the road, the destination, just a lot of that goes into those decisions.
Let me switch over to Mr. Sakalakis, if you'd like to. Jason Sakalakis, can you put yourself on the record and answer that question for Representative Mina?
Yes, Jason Sakalakis, Northern Region Maintenance Operations Chief. Can everybody hear me okay?
We can, sir. Please proceed.
Through the chair, Representative Nina. Thanks, Burrell. First of all, you hit on a lot of the topics that I would cover naturally by establishment of our priority index. The department did do an evaluation of several different factors to establish our priority. Burrell did mention several of them, primarily looking at classification of roadway, whether it was a destination through point, looked at ADT, other safety factors, and basically ranked our roadways in priority based upon those several factors. So it was not one specific item that was looked at. I do know that we also displayed, I'll say, similar information. I know Andy has some of this as well on prior testimonies with regards to all of the factors that went into, I'll say, the priority matrix itself. I don't have those readily available for the presentation today, but could also provide some of that information later too. So.
Yes, please. We'd like that. Mr. Mills, I think, wants to respond as well.
Andy Mills, for the record, just quickly. So the reference that Mr. Sakalakis is mentioning is a legislative intent report that we detail that and fairly well. And so we'll do that. And then just acronyms-wise for all of us, ADT, Average Daily Traffic. We'll try not to talk DOT, which is an acronym itself. So,
thank you. Representative Mina, did you have a follow-up?
I did, yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Through the Co-Chair, and thank you for that information of those different factors that go into the priority levels. Do you also consider safe routes for schools, areas that have high pedestrian fatalities, and also any public input when deciding those priority levels?
Jason, would you, Andy Mills for the record, I'm happy to maybe jump in and then Jason can supplement, but the functional classification piece is actually every census, we then run a functional classification study, and it examines the use and function of certain roads for potential reclassification. And that is just being accomplished this year after a significant effort, just approved. And what we do then is we take a look at any changes that happen in that in conjunction with many of the factors. Schools are part of it as well as emergency services. And so we would be, this 2026 is a good year for us to look at the priority matrix that we have and reevaluate what changes may be necessary. And we could do the same with, of course, sidewalks, where Fairbanks and Anchorage have designation on a priority level that's separated on their sidewalks.
Follow up?
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichscheid. I don't know if we wanted to also ask Mr. Sakalaskas to add on to that question, and I had one more, and I think that covers my three.
So I think, Mr. Sakalaskas, did you have any additional detail for Representative Mina's question?
Jason Sakalaskas, for the record. No, Co-Chair, the information Andy provided was pretty thorough there with regards to functional class address, most of those concerns.
Thank you, sir. Representative Mina, follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Eichscheid. One last follow-up through the Co-Chair. I know just in general, it's hard to coordinate between plowing the sidewalks and the roads at the right time, and we have different times to plow that, but is there any work to help create more synchronicity just for pedestrians?
So, through the chair, Representative Mina, I know Mr. Nickerson can talk about Anchorage specifically, but I know TORA's transfer of responsibility agreements are one way we try to be more efficient in how we handle certain routes, and that can include, hey, if you're in this area, why don't you also do this activity? So that can create the contiguous clearing and whatnot. But I may not let, specifically for your question and to make sure it's responsive to the Anchorage area in particular, let Mr. Nickerson take a stab.
Mr. Nicholson?
Again, for the record, Burrell Nicholson, through the co-chair, Representative Mina. I can tell you that actually our Anchorage office coordinates with the school district quite a bit. Not only that, and I was going to go into it in a future slides, but we've been really in touch with the municipality of Anchorage, and we're trying to work with them as best we can, not only on sidewalks, but roadways, snow hauls, snow dumps, everything like that. School districts will often reach out to us super early in the morning or late at night. They want to know about school closures. They contacted us, or they'll contact us if they need sanding in certain areas or if they have concerns in certain areas. So I'm not really addressing your question with regards to the priority system, just more or less about collaboration and coordination.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Carrick?
Thank you, through the co-chair. Just, I think a lot of what I was going to ask got answered, but I had a few different folks reach out over the last interim and question. I know that the sidewalk priority is just a different system of priority order than the road system, which makes sense. You don't have bike paths along the Parks Highway, for example. But in urban areas like Fairbanks and Anchorage, are they roughly correlated with each other so that if we do those upgrades in the future and can start to have more synchronicity, we can be able to say to our constituents, hey, that priority two sidewalk is also part of that priority two road, and they're going to get plowed around the same time, for example. The other question I had is, we have no sidewalk equipment on the Kenai Peninsula and one piece of equipment in the Matsu. Am I seeing that right? Just curious. And if so, why hasn't the department asked for more equipment for this?
So I might take a step. Go ahead, Jason.
For the record, this is Burrell Nickerson. Yes, what you're seeing on that slide is accurate. What I can say is that Christine's group, as well as maintenance and operations, collaborated on the language as well as kind of the priorities of the sidewalks, with an understanding that limited right-of-way, when you have limited right-of-way, you have to push snow out of the road onto the sidewalk. So how many people use that sidewalk? What are the bus services? What are the needs to get to and from, such as like a hospital, a school, business centers, and things like that? So that kind of all went into the thinking of the sidewalk priorities. I hope that answers the question. Sorry, I should have directed that through the co-chair.
And for the record, one more detail for you is that I think we mentioned that the supplementary contracts are for priority three and priority four roads. They're also for sidewalks. That's one of the intentions, is to have that ability so our operators can stay out on the roads and continue clearing those as contractor assistance can come through and assist with the sidewalks. So just one more piece.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So a question for probably whoever's running South Central, but I'm pretty sure there is bike paths along the Parks Highway. Parks Highway in Fairbanks is, we're not even talking about that. We're talking about the real Parks Highway in the Mat-Su.
Whoa.
So the point being is, are we clearing those, or are we just letting those snow over, like around Willow and Houston and Talkeetna has some significant stretches? So I know they're not all connected necessarily, but.
For the record, Burrell Nickerson. Go ahead, Andy.
Nope, I was going to direct it to you.
For the record, Burrell Nickerson, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. It's situational out there. Sometimes snow machines. I've seen snow machines out there utilizing those things and understand, as a snow machine user of the past, why they're necessary. I've also lived in Fairbanks and understand why snow machines are necessary on the pathways up there as well, too. So when time allows, the crew can to get to that if it comes through on complaints and stuff like that. But, yes, we do take care of that pathway that is along the Parks Highway.
Thanks.
And, southern part of it.
And just interesting comment on those bike paths along our major highways. Interesting tidbit from my own experience. So I'm a year-round runner. I tend not to run on roads because they're not safe. So I use the Greenbelt Trail near my home in Anchorage. And in winter, I run on the skate groomed trail, which is usually firm enough. But in the spring, during breakup, that pack trail gets super icy. And so then I go over to, I park at Bartlett High School, and I run along the Glen Highway because that bike path is plowed during the winter. And so when my Greenbelt trail is ice, that is fairly free of ice. And so about 2 to 3 weeks, I run on that. And it's just, I think, I just want you to know that some of these issues are really important for people's quality of life. So just a comment.
Thank you for that comment. That's good to hear. Next slide, Andy. If I may, I want to go back one more time, and I want to just say that those snow blowers for sidewalks, they are incredibly maintenance intensive. We can blow through shear pins like crazy on big events. And so anyways, they are very maintenance intensive. They can go down very fast, and they're expensive to take care of. Again, this is specific to the sidewalks in Anchorage area and kind of speaks to the right-of-way. Where we have very narrow right-of-way, we cannot push snow off the road and then onto the sidewalk and onto private property. So when we go through on some of these high-speed routes, such as Minnesota, the snow then goes up onto the sidewalk. And depending on when we can get back, the snow then needs to be pulled from the sidewalk back into the roadway, and then it's usually blown into trucks. We try and do that as soon as we can, with an understanding that some of these sidewalks are vital to folks who get around and do not have a vehicle. So this kind of gives you a sense of some of the locations throughout Anchorage, Minnesota Fireweed, and the Seward Highway between 36th and 15th that are our priorities to get to when we can. Northern Lights, Benson, and 5th Avenue are come next. This shows you how many times as of last week that we have hauled from those sites this year. Obviously, that's going to be more after this latest event. Next slide, Andy. One of the other things that we have is the amount of, or as the location where we can dump snow. Currently, Central Region or Anchorage area has one snow dump. Compared to the municipality, which has multiple snow dumps, we are currently working on trying to get authorizations for a second. It's going to kind of expand the existing snow dump where we're at, Horvitz in the south of town. So because of that, we need a great relationship with the municipality of Anchorage, and we do have that great relationship, and they allow us to use some of their dump sites, and that has served us greatly during some of these recent large events. Next slide, Andy.
We did have a question from Representative McCabe.
Yeah, thanks. So through the co-chair, and I'm not sure who is best to answer this, but with the big Juneau snow down here, they ran out of places to put snow, right? And it seems like snow is just frozen water, probably got a little salt in it from the roads, but why don't we just dump the frozen salt water into the saltwater ocean? And I'm pretty sure I know the reason, but to tell the general public why, I mean, I'm sure that the reason is going to say, well, there's pollution in it because it came off the roads, but that pollution is going to wash into the saltwater in Juneau anyways. I think I would bet in Kodiak they're still dumping it into the ocean right off the ferry dock. So maybe you could explain that just for people that are listening.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, Marcus Zimmerman, South Coast Region Maintenance and Operations Chief. During the snow event here in Juneau in December, we were able to gain emergency authorization for DOT to be able to dump directly into the channel. Part of that is the environmental concerns, contaminants in the material into the snow. So when it was fresh snow, we were loading it up, hauling it away immediately. They allowed us to do that, but it was for a very specific event, very specific time frame. Otherwise, they do want you to take the snow to a dump site where you can have environmental controls and stuff.
Follow up. So, and maybe just a comment. So earlier I heard Mr. Mills say that the salt that we use comes from dried, evaporated salt water from the salty ocean, and now we don't want to put that dried salt water from the salty ocean back into the salty ocean?
through the chair, Representative McCabe, I think it has to do with like oils and things like that is more of the concern. Dirt, debris, trash, oil, stuff like that that gets built up in those snow berms and things as you are plowing things to the side of the road, you end up getting car parts and other items that we don't want to be depositing into the oceans.
Okay, fair point. Thanks.
And before we move to Representative Mina, we are having a great conversation. I do still intend to transition at 2:30, but without objection, I would like to continue this conversation perhaps next week, say next Tuesday, as calendars are available for that. But I would like to continue the presentation when we end about 2:30. So, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Through the Co-Chair, could you talk more about the lane reduction test strip at the Anchorage Woodlot? I don't want to bring up any road diet lane drop drama, but is that a lane drop?
Mr. Nickerson on here may have something. You mean for snow storage?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Again, I believe that was a pilot program, and that was only one aspect of it, right? But I'll let Mr. Nickerson speak to it.
Okay.
For the record, Burrell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations Manager, through the co-chair, Representative Mina. Yes, the municipality did set up kind of a pilot down there at the wood lot. I will say that at the time that this presentation was prepared, maintenance and operations hadn't really inspected it or had a lot to do with it. That isn't to say, though, that we aren't in the process of getting out there. And when I say we, I meant the folks in the field, the superintendents, the foremen, and the staff. There are going to be benefits to a situation like that. There's going to be increased snow storage, which would greatly benefit possibly the folks where that utilize the sidewalk, where if we were to push the snow off the road onto the sidewalk, now they don't have as much snow on their way. On the flip side, there's going to be a lot more things like signage, delineators, and things like that that when in use is going to cost more money because they're going to get downed during snowplow operations and things like that. So it's a give and a take, and it's it'll be interesting to see if it does take and what the expenses are and then what the benefits are. But yes, it is something that's being looked at, and I think M&O has it in our sights to talk with the municipality actually within the coming weeks actually about that specific topic.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Well, I again am going to have to agree with my colleague from Big Lake. For years we dumped this snow in the water and in the bays and wherever. So just for the record, I heard you say they don't like us to do it. Could you tell us who they is, please?
For the record, Marcus Zimmerman, South Coast Region Maintenance and Operations Chief, through the chair, Representative Stutes, Department of Environmental Conservation is who regulates that.
Why am I not surprised? Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Andy. I believe this is my last slide, and this is just covering some of the challenges and opportunities that we see in some of the other districts in Peninsula, or excuse me, in Central Region. So, again, this talks about brine use only in certain locations on the Peninsula. Also, we've had an extreme difficulty retaining operators in this current within the last year. I will point out that there might be a later slide that shows a different number of vacancies. It's been constantly a moving target, so there might be a little bit of discrepancy. So I just want folks to be aware of that when they get later on in the slide deck. Matsu specific issues, we've had multiple wind events out there. Current calculations of about $300,000 for repairs. That's going to be ongoing and probably will last into the spring. Again, training up new staff. When old staff retire and we just constantly have new staff, everybody needs to learn the ropes. And it's best to learn the ropes from somebody that's been there for a long time, a tenured employee, something like that. So training up new staff can take some time. Southwest specific issues, I'm sure you all have been familiar with or have heard about the typhoon response. DOT is a big part of that, as well as our contracting community that we spoke about, Andy spoke to earlier. We're also doing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. This is increasing our costs, but we're getting more applicants for our jobs, our operator positions out there. And then the Bethel situation, there's been a tower closure there that we anticipate for the next couple of months. Hopefully it doesn't interfere with a lot of jet operations, but we'll see where that goes. And I believe with that.
Yeah, Mr. Nickerson, this is Co-Chair Eichheit. I had a question before you go. So I appreciate this challenges and opportunities slide. Realizing that fully staffing departments is always a challenge, probably always has been, always will be. From your perspective in the Central Region, what do you need to fully staff your departments, and you know, essentially, what do you need from the legislature? Say, what do you need to reach that 100% fully staffed and operating?
Again, for the record, Burrell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations Manager. One of the differences is Anchorage Station has done a great job at retaining staff. And we seem to be fully staffed in the Anchorage Station, and I believe in Girdwood as well. I think it's just timing on the Peninsula District. It's a little odd, and it just so happens to be during the winter. So I think it ebbs and it flows. So I don't think it's really something that we can pinpoint or speak to. When we're showing that other stations are fully staffed. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it's helpful. I think Mr. Mills wants to make a comment.
Andy Mills, for the record, wanted to add, Mr. Co-Chair, that Last year in the FY26 budget, there was a little over a $5 million reduction in our M&O, which is one area I hear from every legislative office. They would like, their constituents would like us to continue to do well at snow clearing and vegetation control and everything else. But obviously, that reduction scenario, all of the maintenance chiefs have had, you know, year over year to continue to be judicious in how they spend those resources and allocate those. From even a staffing standpoint, overtime, you can maybe a different conversation, but they can talk about how much overtime is necessary to ensure that we're responding in the way that the public is calling us to do. And certainly overtime is a budgetary constraint to manage. So I would just highlight that the FY27 proposed budget does seek to restore that $5 million, and we're making some changes to keep that frontline service strong. But it, in relation to your question post, wanted to make sure you knew that resourcing is part of all of our operators getting out there for the amount of time it takes to do the mission.
Okay, appreciate that. We have two more questions in the queue. I'm going to go to those, and then we'll probably stop after that, right before the Northern Region. So that's a convenient thing. Representative Mina, I think you were next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Through the Co-Chair, so I've received some feedback from some constituents about the difference between the muni roads and the state roads and how they're maintained. And I really commend Mr. Nickerson on your work with the municipality on plowing. So I recently learned that the muni, they have this performance value results initiative where they report out quarterly reports on all of their departments on their goals, performance measures, and outcomes. And so I was looking at that for maintenance and operations. My question is, do you coordinate with your MPOs on what their respective metrics are for plowing? And what are you doing to help create more coordination with your MPOs as you plow roads?
For the record, Burrell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations. Through the co-chair, Representative Mina. Our metrics, we do keep metrics. However, I don't always believe that they get shared. I'm going to use the municipality of Anchorage. They don't get shared, but I would be 99.9% sure that they get discussed when the superintendents chat with each other, probably on a daily basis. I guess that's how I'd answer that question. And I know there's more meetings. In fact, the municipality of Anchorage reached out to myself, my chief, as well as the superintendent, is inviting us to sidewalk coordination meetings with regards to snow and ice control. We might start meeting more often and more frequently. It's very likely that something like our timeframes are going to be evaluated that we have shown on the sidewalk priority. Hope that answered the question.
It does. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So this is probably for Mr. Mills. I'm wondering, I think I've asked this question before, but maybe when the DOT, when you lose employees, when they go to one of our contractors, say, or to a construction company, do you guys do exit surveys on why exactly the employee is leaving?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, there's a, and it's a standard across most state agencies. There is an exit survey that they are provided, and it's a voluntary. It's not required. And I have looked at those in the past, not every single month on a report, but I have from time to time said I want to find out why people are separating, from where, and for what purpose. And I know, I bet there's an informal process from the operator standpoint if any of our M&O chiefs want to comment on that as well.
Apparently not. So anyways, follow up. So just curious, if that, can you provide that data to us, most recent, or is that sort of close hold info?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I can ask. They scrub the report of a lot of, you know, sometimes there are rationales and reasons in there that are HR issues to resolve, or so there's definitely, and they redact the names and information because we want to promote people to give input and not feel as though there's going to be something publicly with their name out there saying some fairly critical things about a supervisor they may one day have to encounter again. So I will see if there's something we can present you that is a truncated form of that.
Thanks. And through follow up, I'm less concerned about individual reports than I am about the aggregate data of why. Okay. So pie chart, the troopers did one a number of years ago, and there was a pie chart. It was 29% this and 5% that and 9% that. So it would be fabulous because DOT is one of our premier agencies. You guys are not only important to us, but you have a lot of employees, and I'd really like to I'd like to know.
And I would like to also kind of add on to what Representative McCabe said. I think that would be super useful for us as a committee to understand, you know, what the levers are for the vacancy issues and how we can help, how we can understand. So but I'd like to thank our DOT staff for being here. We are going to move on to the next item, but I hope we can continue this hopefully next week. So we will be reaching out to DOT. Northern Region is next, and for a future meeting, and really appreciate you all. So I'm just going to, because there's so many people and your names are sometimes hard to say, I'm just going to say thank you all. And then before we move on to our next item, which is hearing a bill from Representative Holland, we're going to take a brief at ease to get ready for that. So here we go, at ease. We are back at the House Transportation Committee on our second agenda item today. Next, we have Representative Holland's bill, House Bill 216. Representative Holland and his aide, Aiden Nickel, are joining us today. Representative Holland, Aiden, welcome to the House Transportation Committee. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you. Co-Chair Eichheit and the Transportation Committee, I am Kai Holland. I represent House District 9. House District 9 is an interesting district that stretches across the Anchorage Hillside from the Basher, Suckingen Heights area, across Glen Alps, Bear Valley, and then the lower hillside area from Huffman Road, but uniquely stretches all the way through Girdwood to Whittier. And so it creates a wonderful district for me to work with that connects Anchorage to the Prince William Sound and to many opportunities for recreation as well as commerce with the fishing industry, the recreation industries, as well as a critical part of our state's transportation infrastructure. It was pointed out to me yesterday that, you know, we sometimes talk about the dream of having a rail connection to the lower 48, and in fact, we have a rail connection from essentially Florida to Fairbanks by rail that allows us to put rail freight on at any point in the country and roll it north, where it then goes onto a rail barge and stays on those railroad cars and comes up to Whittier and comes off and continues on the rails. So we have a really unique asset that is not only serving our economy and our people, but is also critical in the case of emergencies or a need down the road if we ever needed a backup way to be able to bring heavy freight in. And as we look at some major projects that are coming up, including potentially a gas pipeline, Whittier will become an essential part of our ability to move heavy freight in. That includes the barge and other rail items that come in. And I have been really proud to be able to represent the district. And in the process of learning about the district and the opportunity to represent it, I've been able to attend the city council meetings for about a year and a half now each month. And one of the issues that from the very beginning I learned about was their effort and the progress that they had made working with the Alaska Railroad on being able to reach an agreement on the railroad land that the city has been leasing and being able to work towards being able to actually move that land into the ownership of the city, providing the city an opportunity to continue to grow its economy and to give it more flexibility for control over the land. And that process has continued on with a lot of hard work by the city and by the railroad that brings us to today. The Railroad Act and our state statutes give the legislature the oversight of the transfer of any railroad assets and gives us the opportunity to review that transaction. And it requires that the legislature actually approves a transfer of, in this case, land to another party. Some of you may recall this was done a couple of years ago with the Nenana Railroad property and a bill passed by the legislature that completed the transfer of some railroad land to the city of Nenana. So this is, if you've followed that history or want to refer to it, is essentially the same process. The transfer at this point is not completed until both the city and the railroad reach their final purchase agreement, but this is a necessary step for them to be able to complete that process. It's in statute. It says we, the legislature, have to be the ones that say, okay, go forth and do that. And so I just want to acknowledge that this has taken a lot of work. It's a relatively simple procedural action for us, but it's not without, you know, years of effort that have gone to get us to this day. My staff, Aiden Nickel, is going to go through the bill and the sectional and then just the background on this, and then we have invited testimony with the railroad and the city of Whittier to fill in what we can cover today in the brief time we have. So thank you again for the time we have today.
Thank you, Chair Eichheid. For the record, Aiden Nickel, staff to Representative Holland. So for those who are not familiar with the city of Whittier, it is connected to the rest of the state by a multi-use tunnel through the surrounding mountains, and for most of the city's history, this was a rail-only tunnel. So the city has long relied on its partnership with the railroad. In turn, the railroad has benefited from its land holdings in Whittier, which constitute about 85% of the city's land area. In 1998, the railroad leased some of that land to the city, but leasing hasn't allowed the city to reap the full intended economic benefits of the land. Under the current lease, the railroad needs to be able to reclaim the land if it once again becomes essential for its operations, and that, of course, creates uncertainty that discourages investment in the city. And as a state entity, the railroad is tax-exempt, which means that the city is unable to raise municipal revenue from businesses located on that property. And so negotiations have been ongoing for about the last 2 years for the city to take ownership of some of this land, and the two parties came to agreement for terms for a sale in late 2025. However, as Representative Holland mentioned, an obstacle remaining here to the deal is legislative approval under Title 42 of the Alaska Statutes. The railroad is prohibited from parting with any land without this body's authorization. So now that the city and the railroad have partnered to do the hard work of negotiating a deal, it is the legislature's job to clear the way for that sale to proceed. This is a map here of the parcels being negotiated. Early in talks, all five of these parcels that are delineated on the map were going to be conveyed. The current deal that's pending right now only includes the sale of the three parcels in the downtown area. So those are the three parcels over on the right side of the map. However, it is our hope that the other two parcels, those two on the left at the head of the bay, will eventually be conveyed to the city. And this is why you'll see that the language of the bill contains authorization for all five of those parcels. Heading into the sectional analysis here, the text of the bill is straightforward. Section 1 authorizes the railroad to make this transfer. It describes the five parcels of land that the railroad can convey while recognizing that the final boundaries of the parcels being conveyed are not necessarily to be determined by the text of the bill, but by further surveying and platting and the final agreement of both parties. And this section explicitly names that it meets the requirements for the legislative approval under Title 42 governing the Alaska Railroad. And Section 2 establishes an immediate effective date. And with that, Chair Eichheid, I'm going to turn it back over to Representative Holland.
Great. Well, thank you for the time to present this today. Happy to take any initial questions you have and encourage you also to move to also being able to get the invited testimony from the railroad and the city of Whittier while you have time today.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, Representative Holland, Mr. Nickel. There are questions for the maker of the bill before we move to invited testimony. Representative Carrick, Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I have two questions right up front. One, I think, might be to the city manager of Whittier, who's online, I know, but this is a lot of acreage in Whittier. Whittier doesn't have, you know, just a ton of acreage between the mountains and the ocean. So I know that there's a city resolution in support of this land transfer, but I was also just curious to get maybe an opposing viewpoint if there had been that throughout this long history process to try to get this land transfer. Wondering if maybe the city manager could comment on if there has been opposition, what has kind of been that, and what's the counter to it?
So we have online Jackie Wild, city manager of the city of Whittier. Ms. Wild, just put yourself on the record, and if you can address the question from Co-Chair Carrick, please. Stand by, Ms. Wild. We're having some audio issues. Make sure you're not muted on your end, Ms. Wild, because we can't hear you. Go ahead if you can, Ms. Wild. Keep speaking. Just barely. Keep doing a sound check for us.
I'm also going to mess with my stuff and see if that helps at all.
That helps a little bit, but it's still not quite sufficient.
Did I get closer to the microphone?
Yes, yes. That seems to be the variable that's important here.
Miss Wild, so sorry, this is Co-Chair Carrick. We still can't hear you, but we do have a teleconference number that Co-Chair Eichheit could read for you, and if you could potentially call in and not use Teams, that might work better.
Yeah, Miss Wild, I'll give you a number if you're ready to copy, and just go ahead and call that. Say you want to provide invited testimony to the House Transportation Committee, and the ALIO staff will help you. So that number is 844-586-9085. And I'll repeat that, of course. 844-586-9085. And if you can call that number, we'll just go through the phone system rather than Teams. So we hope that to hear from you shortly. I think we also Representative Holland.
Oh, I was just going to suggest, Co-Chair Eichheit, I think Co-Chair Carrick maybe had a couple questions, so perhaps we can take a shot at the other one while this is going on. I'm also happy to address the first question, but it would be best if we can get the city on to address it more fully.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair. The other question I had is in Section 1 in the sectional, it says it recognizes that further platting and surveying is necessary to complete the exchange. So just a simple process question. Is it normal to have that with the Nenanad land transfer? Was that also in there? I'm seeing a lot of head nods. Yes. So just making sure that that's standard language.
Yeah, through the co-chair, to the co-chair, I suspect that Representative McCabe might be able to answer that more fully. But in this case, because of the nature of this land, the recognition is that the description is pretty close, but they wanted the opportunity in the language of this bill to have the opportunity to make any final small changes to the land and not have the bill tangled up by having been overly specific.
Any other questions before Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Through the co-chair, just to clarify, so on the third slide, it mentions that the December 2025 final negotiated agreement is for three parcels, and I know the bill is for five parcels, so could I just get a more clarification on that?
Sure. Thank you. Through the co-chair, and to some degree, this touches back on the first question from co-chair Carrick. The original work, as I know it, but this has been going on for many years, but in the last, you know, a couple of years, had been focusing on all five parcels. There's still some uncertainty about the resolution of the property at the head of the bay. So at this point in time, there is clarity, and I think to co-chair Carrick's question, these three parcels in the downtown area, I think everybody is in complete full agreement on the value and desire to do this. How the head of the bay gets developed has had some needed some additional time to be to develop those ones at this point in time. There's been a lot that's changed in the last couple of years with the addition now of the Hunetotum cruise ship terminal that's been added in there, and the development of the area to the head of the bay. That being said, though, you know, the one parcel, parcel five, has the campground on it, which has been a long-standing opportunity for people who wanted to camp in the Whittier area, so that lease is there. And then the other piece of property, parcel four, has a DOT leased section of land for the Whittier Airport. And so the intent of this is that eventually all five parcels will eventually move towards some sort of agreement. And so the idea was here to put all five into legislation, since they've really worked hard on this, so that they could still proceed with the other two without the delay of having to come back to the legislature at some point in the future to complete those other two parcels.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe?
Yeah, so just maybe a little bit of clarifying. This is, we are just the start. We just authorized this to begin, and then Whittier and the railroad negotiate their terms and their times, and but we've given our blessing. That's all it really kind of is. So,
thank you, and I believe Ms. Wild from the city manager of Whittier is on the phone. So, Co-Chair Carrick, did you get your question answered, or did you want to hear from Ms. Wild?
Co-Chair, I kind of would like to hear from the city manager on this too. Yep. And thank you for joining us. Sorry about the technical issues.
Yeah, Ms. Wild, please put yourself. Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Wild.
So it does say that my microphone is muted, but you are hearing me, correct?
Yes. Yes, a little bit better than before, so really project like a teacher.
Wow, I've never had to be told that before, so this would be pretty good.
It's working. Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. To the chair, I first wanted to answer the question you asked if there had any been any sort of pushback previously on this type of bill. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair to Ms. Wild, yeah, I guess it's a lot of land. Whittier has land is a premium thing, and is there any objection in the past, just trying to capture, I know that the city is in support, but has there been objection, and what's the counter to the objection, if any?
The biggest objection is the master lease. While it does look like Whittier has a lot of land, if you look at it in an overstooping vision, you see that over 90% of it is either state or railroad or other tax non-taxable entities owned. This will give us the opportunity to own land and be able to operate it as a city. Once that question, if I've succeeded with that question, I'd also like to read in my testimony if this is the time.
Yes. Ms. Wild, go ahead and put yourself on the record. I'm not sure if you did that just before, but go ahead and do that, and please provide your invited testimony to the committee.
My name is Jackie Wild with the City of Whittier. I'm the city manager, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of House Bill 216. I want to be clear about the perspective that I bring to this conversation today. I am not here asking for sympathy on behalf of a small community. I'm here to explain how the current structure came to exist and how the function over time, and why HB 216 represents thoughtfulness and collaborative path forward for both the City of Whittier, the Alaska Railroad, and the State of Alaska.
Whittier is home to 273 year-round residents, but we are far more than a residential community. Our residents work here, live here, raise their children here, and because they believe in Whittier's future and see its role in Alaska's transportation system, Whittier sits in its intersection of rail, trail, road, port, and marine access. Our community supports supports port operations, rail accesses, marine transportation, trail access, emergency services, utilities, year-round infrastructure, and serve not only Whittier, but the statewide movement of people, goods, and commerce. Another important piece of the context is Whittier's tax base. The majority of the land within city is tax exempt, owned by the state of Alaska, the federal government, or other state entities, including the Alaska Railroad Corporation. For many years, this structure has left much of Whittier's tax base tied up, resulting in very limited number of taxable parcels responsible for funding municipal services that also support statewide transportation and commerce. For many years, the relationship between the city of Whittier and the Alaska Railroad was governed by a master lease. While entered into with good intentions, the structure placed extensive municipal responsibilities, planning, permitting, infrastructure maintenance, utilities, public safety access on the city, while ownership and ultimate control of the land remained with the railroad. Over time, the separation of the responsibility and the control became increasingly difficult to manage. This is not a failure of partnership, but a structural mismatch. Projects required workarounds. Infrastructure investments became more complex. Federal funding opportunities were harder to pursue because site control was unclear. Throughout this period, the city continued to meet its obligations, and over decades, Whittier has paid approximately 40% of its total revenues to the Alaska Railroad through leases and land-related payments. We do so because we understood railroads' importance to the state and because we believe in being a reliable partner. Over the last years, the City of Whittier's administration has worked closely and collaboratively with the Alaska Railroad Corporation's administration to address the challenges. Together, we have moved away from managing around misalignment and toward identifying a structure that better reflects on how land is actually used and how responsibilities are actually carried today. The parcels addressed in House Bill 216 were conveyed by the State of Alaska Railroad for public purposes. By the State of Alaska to the railroad for public purposes. Over time, many of these parcels became non-operational to rail services while remaining essential to municipal infrastructure, public safety, and transportation connectivity. HB 216 does not revisit past decisions or assign fault. It reflects a shared recognition developed through sustained coordination that existing structure no longer serves either party well and that more an aligned approach is needed. The parcels identified in HB 216 are non-operational to the railroad, yet central to roads, utilities, emergency response, environmental remediation, and equality for the state and federal infrastructure funding. Today, the city is responsible for planning, maintaining, and funding infrastructure on land it does not own and cannot tax, which increases cost and complexity for both a city and for a state. Because the Alaska Railroad is a state-held entity holding land in trust for people of Alaska, they cannot transfer cannot occur administratively. Legislative authority is required to convey ownership. HB 216 provides the authority carefully and responsibly.
Ms. Wild, yes? Just if you can kind of wrap up your invited testimony, just because we're running up against time, and if you can just briefly summarize it here at the end, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead.
I can actually summarize it. The summary is, at its core, HB 216 is a governance bill. It recognizes that the land no longer serves its original state of purpose, and when responsibility and infrastructure have shifted to municipality and ownership and authority, Whittier is unique even among Alaska communities, and we are where the rail ends, the highway disappears, and the port begins. When land ownership, responsibility, and purpose are aligned in Whittier, the entire state benefits from more effective and efficient transportation system. HB provides the alignment carefully, lawfully, and full protection of the state's interest. I respectfully ask for your support in working towards something together with the Alaska Railroad.
Thank you, Ms. Wild. Are there any questions from the committee for Ms. Wild? Okay, thank you, Ms. Wild. And we will move to another invited testimony from Megan Clemens, Director of External Affairs for the Alaska Railroad. And so, Ms. Clemens, if you can put yourself on the record, and again, if you can be brief, and my apologies.
No, certainly. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Carrick, Co-Chair Eichscheid, and committee members. For the record, my name is Megan Clemens, and I'm the External Affairs Director for the Alaska Railroad. And yes, I have a brief statement that I will share today. Thank you for the opportunity to express the Alaska Railroad's support for House Bill 216, which would authorize the railroad to sell identified parcels of land to the city of Whittier. I'll start by noting that selling land isn't something that the railroad takes lightly. So as you know, the process to sell railroad land requires not only legislative authorization, but also railroad board approval, with our board obligated by statute to find that the land is not necessary for railroad purposes and that a sale would serve the best interest of the state, as we remain focused on our mandate to maintain Alaska's rail network and provide safe and reliable transportation for goods and passengers. So it's important to highlight, as has been stated today, that over the last 2 years, the railroad and the city have engaged in ongoing discussion and negotiation in pursuit of a mutually beneficial land sale. Through this process, the scope of the proposed sale has evolved and refined, as we've discussed today, culminating in a proposal offered by the railroad at our board's direction to sell three parcels in Whittier's core downtown district at fair market value as required by statute. Following this proposal, we were pleased to receive a conditional letter of intent from the city just last week, and we are now looking forward to a resolution formally approving the sale of areas of interest 1, 2, and 3 coming before the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors at their next meeting on February 5th. As has been mentioned, the legislation includes authorization to sell those two additional parcels, areas 4 and 5. And just to clarify that completing the sale of parcels 1, 2, and 3 would in no way preclude revisiting 4 and 5 for a potential sale to the city of Whittier at some time in the future. And in fact, having legislative approval to sell those parcels to the city could help expedite that process should we receive that guidance from our board at a future time. So with that, thank you again for the opportunity to speak today in support of this legislation. It's our hope that this land sale is responsive to the needs of the community and the railroad, helps the city realize its goals for local growth and prosperity, and sets the stage for an ongoing productive relationship between the railroad and the city of Whittier for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clemens. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Clemens?
One.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Ms. Clemens, I just kind of been cruising the Nenana one. This is substantively the exact same thing.
Yes, this is obviously the land descriptions are different, but it has been noted this is a fairly simple authorization for this land conveyance to occur. Yes, the bill is very much the same.
And any final questions for Representative Holland? Okay, thank you. We're just going to take a brief at ease. I just have to ask my co-chair something, I think. At ease. Record. Just with the committee, we are thinking about setting an amendment deadline for this bill on next Monday, February 2nd at 5 p.m. I just want to see if there was any objection to that. Seeing none, so the amendment deadline will be next Monday, February 2nd, 5 p.m. Please work with both co-chair staff prior to that. And I would like to thank everybody today for your good work. The next House Transportation Committee meeting will be Tuesday, February 3rd at 1 p.m. in Room 124. The presentation will be on the role of advanced construction in DOT and PF project administration. The department will also provide a review of federal aid and types of federal funding accessible to DOT. This meeting of the House Transportation Committee is now adjourned at 3:05 p.m.